Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 238, Cool Heroism and the Great Rethinking.
Gandhi said once when they were having a session in his ashram, and people were discouraged about his getting India free from the British colonial domination, and things were not looking good. And people said to him, "Well, Mr. Gandhi, though," thinking of sources of hope, they said, "Well, Mr. Gandhi, though, what about American civilization?" And Gandhi's response was, "American civilization? Now that would be a good idea." And actually, Indian civilization, a lot of what I'm going to talk about today, the concept of cool heroism, I think is something that has been elaborated. It is not unique, of course, to Asian civilizations, not at all. But it is something that was elaborated in a technical way and in a practical way, and in the history of Indian civilization, I think perhaps more than almost any other. Three great teachers in Indian history that I can think of would be, of course, Shakyamuni the Buddha, and then the great philosopher Nagarjuna, and then the great philosopher and poet Shantideva, who respectively lived around 500 before the Common Era, around 100 of the Common Era, and around 750 of the Common Era. So spanning over 1,000 years in Indian history. Their yoga, which is called the famous yoga of the exchange of self and other, the equal exchange of self and other, I think really is sort of the key teaching of the yoga of cool heroism, the yoga of practical nonviolence. But anyway, to come back to something more familiar to you all, by good luck today, I happened to, in the train, the very delightful train coming from Paddington Station, which I enjoyed very much, the ride here, I was reading a manuscript that was sent to me by the publisher for some sort of a blurb, a comment, by this charming gentleman who I actually have heard talk, and I know him a little bit, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and it's called God Has a Dream, A Vision of Hope for Our Time. And I was thinking, I was lamenting a little bit in coming that I didn't bring with me a copy of Shantideva's book, a translation or whatever, because I like to, in talking on this topic, read just even a verse or two from Shantideva, the great teacher of the exchange of self and other and the yoga of cool heroism, just so that people just don't think I made it all up on myself, since I am neither cool nor a hero, and therefore people might justifiably be skeptical with me going on about cool heroism without quoting someone more accomplished than I. And so how delightful it was to deal with Bishop Tutu and to read his delightful book, which begins every chapter with referring to children of God. He addresses us all, the reader, as dear child of God, which of course is always a stretch for me since I don't really believe in the same God that he does in some way. But in another way, I do believe in his notion of the force of love and the force of creativity and the force of freedom in history and in the world. I just don't believe in anything omnipotent. You know, the Buddha actually met God, they say. There's a famous story where Buddha, in his previous life as a bodhisattva, when he was a yogi looking for the nature of reality, he developed the yogic power to go out of body and to go into divine realms, heavenly realms, of which the Indians have about 24 levels, very elaborated, which you can reach in somatic states. And he went to the one where the creator god, what the being believed to have been the creator god in Indian civilization at that time, Brahma, mighty Brahma. And he met mighty Brahma. And he asked him, he said, "Oh, mighty Brahma, I heard you are the creator of the world. Since you are, could you kindly tell me, I who am seeking to know the true nature of things, what was there before there was earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness?" And Brahma's answer to him was, "Do you know how busy I am? I have a lot of problems on my mind. I have a lot of things to do. You're coming here and bothering me with silly questions," and et cetera, et cetera. He gave him a kind of Wizard of Oz reception. You know, like, "Don't bother me," sort of thing. So then the Buddha, as a bodhisattva, withdrew. He said, "Oh, I'm sorry, God, Brahma, great Brahma. I didn't mean to bother you. I'll take off now, go back to my meditation. Please take care of the universe, no sweat." But as he was leaving, then Brahma sneaked around the outside and said, "Hey, come over here." Just like, he didn't have Toto with him, but it's very like the Wizard of Oz scene. He came around and said, the god came out from behind the curtain himself. And he said, "Hey, come over here. Come here, Buddha." So he goes over, and then God says to him, "You know, I can't send you away disappointed. It's just that I couldn't answer you honestly in front of all the godlings in my court. Because the truth of the matter is, I don't know the answer to your question. Why? In this particular cycle of the universe, it was just that I was the first being to show up. And I was suddenly here all alone. And I didn't really know what was going on. And I was wondering where everybody was. Sort of remembering there used to be some other people from the previous universe. And at that moment, pop, 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 all these other godlings showed up all around me. And when they saw me, having preceded them, they said, 'Dada.' So at first I said, 'I'm not your dada. We're in this together,' type thing. And then they looked so frightened and so confused that I sort of said, 'Well, okay, I'll be dada.' So they think I am dada. And they think I created this and I'm in charge and in control. But the fact is, I don't know what is going on. Not exactly. I have a lot of good ideas, but I don't exactly know what is going on. However, I can tell in some lifetime soon, you are going to come to an understanding of the nature of reality. And at that time, I want two favors from you, from my honest answer to you. One, I want you to come and let me in on it. And two, I want you to tell human beings and other creatures that when things go wrong for them and they suffer the untold miseries that they do, it's not my fault. I did not create those nasty things. I'm subject to it as much as them. And we have to work it out together," type of thing. So this is a wonderful story, I think. When Buddha recounted that story 2,500, 2,600 years ago, there were many high priests in that culture whose institutions were founded on people's belief in a creator god. And yet they didn't burn him at the stake. They didn't like immolate him. They didn't destroy him. They even like enjoyed his teaching, in fact, which is a good sign about the tolerance of Indian civilization even at that time. We can imagine a few centuries ago, even in a place even like this, a story like that would get you out there on a nice piece of good old, solid old English firewood. Although today we can laugh and relax about it, although perhaps some of us may worry. When I tell this story in the American Middle West, I always have to stay silent for a moment afterwards while people wait for the rumble of thunder and the lightning bolt. And when the lightning bolt has not so far struck, then there's a palpable feeling of relief in the room, actually. So I therefore enjoy telling it, I must confess. I do. So, but anyway, Bishop Tutu, he has a marvelous chapter. He says, "Dear child of God, if we are truly to understand that God loves all of us, we must recognize that he loves our enemies too." Yes, God does not share our hatred, no matter what the offense that we have endured. We try to claim God for ourselves and for our cause, but God's love is too great to be confined to any one side of a conflict or to any one religion. And our prejudices, regardless of whether they are based on religion, race, nationality, gender, sexual orientation, or anything else, are absolutely and utterly ridiculous in God's eyes. Now that is spoken like a true, cool hero. And I think why I say this is particularly fortuitous, and I won't presume to teach for Bishop Tutu, as I'm not exactly in that tradition, but I think it's very fortuitous because right now, we are standing in the planet in what, in a day or two from now, Andrew Harvey will describe to you, as he calls it, the hour of God, when we are put to the trial. I'm an American. I'm 62 years of age. I came of age perhaps a little bit before the 60s, but certainly during the 60s. And I thought we had our last horrible regression to medieval Neanderthal mindset with Nixon. Then I thought we were having, well, another round of rubbing it in with Reagan, when somehow Carter was thrown out, although he was doing a great job, just because he had a funny accent. But he had that toothy smile. And then, what can we, you can't even believe what is taking place now in my country, in this country that I don't even recognize. Although maybe perhaps it is the bearing naked of actually the negative side of that country for all to see finally by someone so stupid that they really don't understand what they're doing. I hope. But in any way, since we are in a situation like that, we're very likely to feel, and the key to being caught in that situation is our despair and our feeling of our inability and our feeling of the impotence of cool heroism or even any kind of coolness, and our feeling of fright and wish to flee from the kind of sort of fascist thing that is going on. And at that time, it is this old problem that we have, stereotype, that goodness is weak and powerless, and evil and stupidity is powerful and will crush, therefore, inevitably the good. You know, Caesar versus Jesus, you know, this is rubbed in the Western mindset, not since Jesus' time, actually, but since Constantine's time, since the Roman Empire a little bit co-opted the teaching of Jesus. And so that is what makes this possible. We could not be dominated by such inferior characters, except that we are all hopeless and despaired, and we feel impotent. In America, you know, less than half the people vote, because they are persuaded by corporate-controlled propaganda media, controlled by the same corporations that make war implements nowadays since Reagan. You know, Westinghouse, General Electric, these companies make military engines of various kinds, and they control now the main mass organs of mass media. And so because of that, everyone is so despaired, so no one votes. Not enough people vote. So small, fanatical, intolerant, backward-thinking minority can dominate. So therefore, we're likely to forget that a mere 12 or so years ago, 10 years ago, South Africa, which was the symbol of racism, practically just a really a slightly transposed version of slavery, a symbol of obduracy, of stubbornness, of nuclear-powered prejudice and violence, suddenly opened in a miracle. And after opening in a miracle, rather than having a reverse bloodbath, a reverse disaster, although, you know, AIDS and things, people leave us to believe there's like a lot of crises going on. The media does. Nevertheless, Bishop Tutu precisely oversaw this, what was it, Council on Reconciliation. Oh, I forgot the exact name, something, committee or council or something on truth and reconciliation, in which he would sit, and I remember seeing video of him sitting, listening, with his eyes rolling, and other members of these panels, to these former torturers, murderers, you know, racist, you know, dominators, recounting the tale of their atrocities, and for the most part being forgiven in some sort of public thing. I mean, something inconceivable, incredible. Even when you see it going on, you think, this must be a mistake. This can't be happening on this planet. This is like, I mean, they're all going to go kill each other later. How can this be that these people are, you know, how can this level of trust and forgiveness and transcendence even be possible? But that is an activity of cool heroism. And that is an activity that won an election in just, if it were 1995 or something, 1990, no, even late, more recently. And then there's the Soviet Union. You know, the Soviet Union was said to be, in America anyway, I don't know here exactly what the level of propaganda about it was, but that was inevitable. You know, you never lay their weapon down. They never get tired of it. They're the end of the world. You know, we have to keep our guard up, et cetera, et cetera. Endless atrocities in the name of defending against that. And then they said, forget about it. They let go of the Ukraine. They let go of, like, you know, they said, they made that choice that the cool hero must make, the cool heroine, the cool hero must make, which is a choice that, all right, I'm not going to live by hatred any longer. Or even if I'm calm and cool driving to work in my automobile, I allow hatred to still dominate my society by the military budget, by the nuclear weapons and missiles poised and aimed everywhere, by the prison system with like million black people in a prison, by all of the different things that in fact are still in place around supposedly the mild liberal person. But the whole hero must make a choice at some point that the life that is defended paranoidly through the systematic and intense oppression of others, what am I defending? Where is the freedom in that? Tutu, in this book, he talks about how in the apartheid type of society, the people on top, the people and privileged people, the people who dominate and imprison and have the control laws and the pass laws and all of the horrible mechanisms of oppression and dehumanization are dehumanized themselves in subscribing to those policies, in subscribing to those institutions, in allowing these things to go on in their own name. And they therefore have lost their freedom. America today has more people in prison than any country in the world, perhaps with the exception of China. In China, statistically, it doesn't seem like prison. They call them work camps, the laogai. So they have actually a lot more, in fact. But the China wouldn't probably accept that the world global corporations support the current Chinese government. Otherwise, they would have gone down with the Soviet government after Tiananmen Square. They were on their way. They were on their way, but then the corporate people kept them going. You know, our dear American, my New York fellow New Yorker, Henry the K, who works for them, and Bush Senior. You know, they told him, "Go ahead, it's okay. You can clean up Tiananmen Square. You can crush them. We'll support you anyway. We'll do business with you anyway. We'll use your cheap labor to make all of our products and re-import them back into our country." And so that government still persists, although it hasn't got a shred of legitimacy, in fact, in the eyes of its own people. Only of Communist Party members, who are the oligarchy there. So I guess U.S. can share it with China, the glory of the continued distorted mode of world governance. So South Africa is something we should remember. The Soviet Union's peaceful dissolution is something we should remember, because the key to the current crisis is that we can win. I think, actually, I have to take my hat off to you in England, although I don't know who here is from England and who's from U.S. and who's from where. I have no idea. But those of you who are from England, I do take my hat off to you. I believe your turnout in the peace movement recently, which seems to have failed, they have us convinced because they went ahead and they blasted Iraq anyway, the foolish people who are stuck there in like quagmire number, the ultimate quagmire, probably. But that piece, you all did a fantastic job here the way you turned out, I thought. We were very inspired by it in America, by the incredible turnout. And you are to be applauded as cool heroes for doing that. Cool. Someone was telling me in London yesterday that people were calling up, you know, because it came around on the internet, the information about it, and then people wanted to dutifully, they would call up any sort of peace group or something and saying, I want to come to the demonstration. How can I register? Because nobody's used to this. Like, there was nobody to register. You just register by putting your body out there in the street. And, you know, when people do that, then there's nothing that they can do. There's nothing that the power addicts who are still seem to be in control, although I think they're very desperate in reality. There's nothing they can do if everybody goes out and registers in that way. So anyway, cool heroism. Now the second, so we can remember our recent history and we can take heart when it comes to the moment of cool heroism. Cool heroism is going out in the street. Cool heroism is not accepting these half-wit politicians while not being angry with them. We have to remember that God loves, Bishop Tutu will remind me that God loves George Bush. but perhaps not in quite the cushy, privileged, Yaley type of Texas way he thinks. God will love George Bush by sending him out to sort of do surgery or something, or clean up the fields and deal with the deformed births and all of the disasters that he has already inflicted on Afghanistan and Iraq and many places. And maybe George Bush will have to go and experience a few executions with him on the other side of the electricity that he loves to pull. So I know I don't applaud that. I wouldn't, but I know it's funny. But I would be sorry about that. We would be sorry about it. But maybe he would need that to break through his armoring that makes him unable to feel what he likes to inflict. He thinks it's funny when he inflicts it on people as governor of Texas. Or now he did execute the first federal prisoner in the United States in like 50 years or something recently. He executed. He got his little excitement out of that. But still, George Bush's are, and the Buddhists would not say God, it's not that God loves him, although there must be some God that does, but the Buddhists would say George Bush has been our mother. George Bush has been a family member to us all in previous life. One of the great things Tutu does, see, he does it with God, which is sort of easy for people. He says, God wants us all to be family, wants us all to be brothers and sisters. And he goes on like that. The Buddhists, since they don't have a creator, you see, they believe in God, though. Buddhists are not atheists. Please get over that stereotype. There's so many gods the Buddhists believe in. They're dealing with them, and goddesses, they're dealing with them all the time. But it's just there's no one who's omnipotent. There's no one. There are good gods, there's negative ones, there's sort of demonic, stupid ones. They tend to get a little egotistical, gods do, you know, because they're like, you know, they're God after all. You know, they're like, big deal, you know. But they're not omnipotent, and actually they tend, if they're still egotistical, if they're still afflicted by ignorance, according to Buddha's view, cause of all of our suffering, which is our failure to understand our true relationality is actually all that it is. I think I have to tell you what Buddhism is. I always hate to do that, even though it's not the topic. But it's foundational to the topic. I have to tell you what it is. Because I think people don't know. They think Buddhism is some sort of mental anesthesia. You go and you sit in a... And then you sit there, and then somehow, eureka, you disappear. And everything is fine because it all disappeared. The insoluble situation of the world is gone. And that's nihilism, that's not Buddhism. That's completely incorrect. Buddha is a teacher of the art of happiness, as the Dalai Lama rightfully called his book. He always was. He never is a teaching of the futility of life or the inevitable suffering of life. He only harps on suffering to get people to do what is necessary to overcome it. It's like he honestly diagnoses a symptom. What the Buddha said was that if you're unenlightened, you're bound to suffer. But that's an obvious thing, really. It's not complicated. Why? And then now this is my little brief usual introduction to Buddhism for you, what really Buddhism is. You see, everyone here in this room, like we can make it so simple. Everyone here in this room, except those who are enlightened, and I know you won't be offended, because you won't mind that I mistake you for an unenlightened one. But otherwise, I am unenlightened, so I can include myself. Everyone in this room thinks secretly, as my old Mongolian teacher used to say, decades before the Matrix, everyone secretly thinks, I'm the one. I'm the main event in this room. Now, you know more, you know better than to announce that. If you're a little older, only babies announce it like, ah, I'm the one, bring me the breast. Grown-up people say, oh no, after you, you, oh you, yes. They say, but secretly they're still thinking, I'm the one. But they say that you're the one to you because they know that you think you're the one. They know how deluded you are. Because two people can't be the one. And each of you knows that everybody else in the whole room disagrees with you. They all think they're the one. You know you are. But then you know, you get used to it, you get resigned to it. And you sort of like act like we're going to share it. And occasionally you fall in love with someone and you say, oh, you're the one, for a short time. And then occasionally they fall in love with you and they say, oh, you're the one. Then you feel good. But then that only lasts a rather short time, unfortunately. And so what Buddha was saying is obvious to us all, is that as long as you think you're the one, and as long as the universe doesn't agree with you, you're the loser. You're going to be frustrated. You're going to go say, hey, I'm the one. And everybody's going to say, goodbye. Not for us. And then you can have a tantrum. You can do this. You can invent a nuclear weapon. You can do whatever you like. And you still won't be the one. And you're therefore going to be frustrated and frustrated and suffer. So that's what Buddha said. He says, he looked at a group of people. He said, this here is suffering. And then people got all confused, even the poor Pope. He said, Buddhism, how can anybody, Buddhism is so depressing. Who needs it type of thing? And in the Threshold of Hope, he wrote that. Well, Cardinal Ratzinger wrote it for him. And then he got in trouble in Sri Lanka. They got all irate, the monks. But Buddha only said, if you persist in being the center of the universe, with the universe not accepting you, as it will not, then you will suffer. However, the good news, that's just a surface diagram. The good news is you can easily discover that you're not the one or that you're only one of the ones, to make it sound less drastic. See, because a lot of people have misunderstood Buddhism as thinking that the big discovery is, oh, I'm not the one. So then I'm the one who knows I'm not the one. So therefore, I'm the one who isn't here. So therefore, I'm cool. And I can tell you how many uneasy snickers I've gotten in Zen centers and Buddhist centers when I tease them and I say, oh, you had a 3-year retreat, 3-week retreat, 3-day retreat, 24-hour retreat, and then you had the big disappointment at the end. Weren't you disappointed? And they say, what do you mean? I said, there you were. You're still there at the end. You're like, emptiness, emptiness. Let me disappear. Emptiness, emptiness. And then you can have states of disappearing. I'm gone. I'm not here. There's no gurgling in my stomach. There's no pain in my butt. I can't remember my anxieties. But then suddenly they go bing on the bell and here I am again. Oh no, I got a parking ticket. My foot hurts. I'm late for supper. My pension check is canceled by Enron. They stole my pension. It's so disappointing. You're still there. And then they snicker, you know, like, but they secretly are thinking they're going back for another 10-year retreat, and then they will finally disappear. So Buddhists misunderstand it too, totally, often. But Buddhism means that you can easily discover that you are neither the one, in the sense of being absolute, intrinsically real, independent, self-sufficiently established entity in the sort of most important entity in the universe, nor are you simply non-existent. You are just one of the ones. We are all here together, totally interconnected. Each of us empty of anything separate from everybody else. Meaning each of us full of being a relational nexus totally interconnected to everybody else and conventionally and temporarily independently self-responsible, self-responsive, loving, feeling, interconnected, compassionate. This is what we are here together. We are truly relational. We are, as the Lakota Indians say, all one family, all beings, not just all humans. You know, Bishop Tutu mainly isn't all humans, you know, because that's the Christian thing, the Western thing, or Abrahamic thing. But in the East, all beings, every animal too, is our mother, actually. Every animal too is interwoven, interconnected with us. Every animal has been. All of you here have been my mother in previous lives. Many times. Sorry. I've been your mother, every single one of you. I gave birth to you as a mammal, that is. You know, it's especially hard to be a mom as a mammal because you have to have the baby inside you for some long time. Then it's a real pain getting it out. Then you have to, like, it's helpless for years and you have to deal with it. Then it's a teenager. That was a big noise. So, we've all done this for each other endless times. And also every animal has done it, in the Buddhist view. See, the Buddhists, instead of having God creating us all as children of God, God being just sort of a label for the infinite, something transcending the idea of personality or impersonality or person or male or female, you know. But in the Buddhist thing, it's because of the infinity of the universe, the beginninglessness of life, the fact that we've all been interliving, we've all been interbeing, interwoven with each other for an infinite past. We all have an infinite past. Therefore, we've had infinite interconnection. And guess what? We have an infinite future. And therefore, we're going to be here. Here we are. Went to great trouble. Robin and Cody organized the Prophets Conference. A little scary, that title. But the great rethinking, that's good. That's easier. And we came from all over and we flew here. And we kids, isn't that some of you walked here through the hallowed halls. But we've met each other infinite numbers of times in the past. And we're going to be here infinite numbers of times in the future. And also, we'll be here with all of the people we don't want to be here with. Next Prophets Conference, George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld are going to be in the front row. But they'll probably be reborn female just for a little learning experience. If they're lucky enough, it'll be Georgette and Donalita. And they'll be like, you know, or maybe they'll be gay lovers. Just to kind of get them a little hipper, a little more style conscious. So we can't get rid of anybody. You realize that that's a strong incentive to become enlightened. And not only that, but to share it to make sure everybody else becomes enlightened. Because who would want to keep being here forever unless we were all enlightened? Enlightened meaning, remember, not that we're all here sort of and not here, but that we're all here in such a way that is the opposite from the ordinary way. The ordinary way is that we're all here sort of with each other on sufferance because we're sort of forgiving each other that you don't recognize that I'm the one. You forgive me that I don't recognize that you're the one. We're all here trying to get the most out of each other and nobody's getting enough. And so we're like watching our wallet and we're looking and we're like paranoid. The opposite of that is we're here, each one forgetting about themselves, totally for everyone else. So there's one less person looking out for you, and that's yourself. But everybody else is looking out for you. It's the concept of a Buddha land. I call it a food fight universe. But that's probably because I'm American and I'm thinking of John Belushi. You know, here we're like each person's got their food and they're eating their thing and they're starving. Well, too bad. There isn't enough. I have to have mine. But in such a universe, everyone is giving everyone else their food. So instead of eating your own food, you're giving it to everybody else. And everybody else is giving their food to you. What does that sound like? That sounds like a food fight. It's like you take your shirt off and give it to everybody, then you don't have one shirt. And then all of your shirts come out like me, like I'm a laundromat. But that's the Buddhist, that's the Buddha universe. That's called a Buddhaverse, I call it. Buddha Kshetra, field of enlightened beings. So how do we get there? So it's clear, it's logical, it's totally logical. Cool heroism is totally logical. This planet will be a peaceful planet. Real peace. There'll be real peace on this planet when every individual person, or the vast majority at least, of persons are willing to die rather than to kill. Today, unfortunately, many persons are trainable to be willing to die in order to kill. But they're not just trained to kill. They're trained to be willing to die in order to kill, which is kind of paradoxical. So the pretense that everyone is out for survival and no one can transcend their grasping at their own life is false, and militaries wouldn't exist if that were so. If everybody was just too scared to risk death, there would be no violence because they wouldn't go out and fight. And everyone would say to George, what George said in the Vietnam War, which is, no thanks, I'm staying in Texas. If everybody did that, there'd be no war. The generals would give orders and you go. Wouldn't it be fun to see Saddam Hussein and George Bush and Osama bin Laden in mud wrestling on World Wrestling Federation out there, you know, beating each other up? And that would be it, the end of it. The winner takes all. Saddam Hussein would take Texas, I think. He's a little bigger and stronger, I think. We would have to have champions, and then the rest of us could stay home. But the logical syllogism is, as long as people can be brainwashed and trained and conditioned to be hot heroes, what I call hot heroes, that is to say, use the emotion of hate directed at a demonized enemy in order to sacrifice your life to kill them, we will have continued to have violence. As long as that's the only institution, the militaristic institution, that has a monopoly on dishing out the human reconditioning to help people overcome their survival instinct in order to kill, on the pretense that someone else is going to survive, a loved one, a nation, you know, a religion, whatever it is, somebody's going to survive. I'll die, but I'll kill a lot of the enemy. So logically, as long as that's the case, there will be no end to the violence. But when more people will refuse that order, they'll refuse that training and that conditioning, they will say, no, you can kill me, but I won't kill. That's what Jesus said. Turn the other cheek. Don't hate your enemy. Buddha said, hatred will not put an end to hatred. Only love can put an end to hatred. Both of them said that. And every other great teacher said that. And nobody still is listening. But it's just logical. It isn't, and it isn't some do-gooder fantasy. It's logical. We all refuse. And we make that risk. You know, Gandhi got in a lot of trouble here in England in the world before the World War when he said, the Nazis, the Germans, because nobody quite knew what they were going to amount to before the war. But he said, as far as I'm concerned, you Brits here are the Nazis. You're chopping off the thumbs of our weavers to make us export our cotton to England. You're like beating us up and torturing us and shooting us down when we protest. You're our Nazis. Why should we fight some Germans? And besides, if we fight them, that makes them stronger. Nonviolently is the way that you should resist evil, he said. Then they got all upset. Gandhi wants to surrender to the Nazis, blah, blah, blah. They got really excited. Then he said, excuse me, you misunderstood me, he said. I never said surrender. Nonviolent resistance is not surrender. Nonviolent resistance is, we're not going to fight you and kill you, but we're not going to do what you want either. We're going to stand here in your face until you stop your aggression and your hostility. So then they said to him, that's what I'm talking about, he says. There's three approaches to evil, Gandhi said. He clarified, Manchester Guardian, I think, 1930-something. There's three approaches to it. One is to surrender to it and do its bidding. That's the worst. I'm not saying that's what you think I'm recommending, that you all become Nazis. I don't say that. The second is to fight evil violently. And so that's a kind of heroism. That's hot. He didn't use the term I do, hot and cold, but that's hot heroism. And that's better than surrendering. But the best and the only one ultimately that's effective is to fight violence nonviolently. To lay your life on the line, not to kill, and to let the enemy know that you will resist them to the death, but not by killing them. What that will do is that they will run over you at first. Therefore, some will die. But then they will stop running over people who are not resisting them violently. They're getting orders from a ruler who says they're all out for you. They're all trying to kill you, so kill them. And then they see that you're not trying to kill them. Then they can't obey that order. Then their system of paranoia crumbles from within, says Gandhi. When they are loved beyond their violence, even by people willing to die not to kill them, this will overcome them, he said. I know it sounds incredible to us, but we see it. We've seen it. We saw it in Czechoslovakia just now. Our history is distorted, you understand, in America and in England. We are taught a false history. We are taught that Caesar is more important than Jesus. Because we were taught by Romans, in fact. We are taught that Bush is more important than Bishop Tutu, than the Dalai Lama. But this is false history. That's not true. They are not more important, temporarily only. And if we would recognize that they were not, then they would lose all importance, and we'd be free. So Gandhi taught that already then. And then people said to him, well, but Mr. Gandhi, they would kill so many people before they finally realized that they were in a world different from the world that Hitler is telling them they're in. A world where everybody hates them, and therefore they're justified in attacking and dominating them. They're not in such a world. By the time they realize that their tanks will have rolled over so many bodies, many people will have died. And Gandhi responded, yes, of course. That's why it's heroism to face a violent, evil enemy nonviolently. But when you fight them violently, many people will die also, he said. And how many people did die? And then Gandhi said this, which is really critical to us. He said, you allies, of course, you fight violently then, and you will win because there are more of you than there are Hitler or Mussolini or the Japanese. The allies are more numerous, you will win. But in the process of winning, the same type of people will take over your societies, and you will not get rid of them easily, he said. Now, any red-blooded American, they don't want to think like that. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, Stalin took over. He kept his hold over, let us say, Russia. Oh, yeah. The bad guys kept Russia. Sure. So Gandhi was right there. Gee, they're really bad guys. KGB and Stalin, etc., took over Russia. Yeah, they're really bad. But our people are really good. General Eisenhower, Truman, etc., the CIA, the Pentagon. Well, they're nice. Really? How many other people in the world think they're nice since World War II? How many people? I've been traveling the world since the 50s myself. And I have been greeted in different countries as an American. And the popularity level has gone down and down and down and down and down and down and down. Even in countries that have some reason to think that we might have been helpful at some time. Down and down. And now I think it's at the absolute nadir, although we have a government in place in America that is planning to make us even more unpopular, unfortunately. Wait till they start unleashing their latest generation of little nukes. Tactical. They are wanting to deploy. They're spending billions of dollars on deploying little bunker busters, just little dinky ones. 100 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb, each of them. But, you know, just to put under Baghdad in case there's somebody down there in the tunnel somewhere. It's really sick. So Gandhi was correct, is my point. We were taken over in our name. People were slaughtered in Central America in our name. guns are being sold to both sides of every kind of genocidal conflict, tribal conflict in Africa. Oh, but it's somehow Africans are just crazy. Well, oh, they're crazy with our guns. I remember Richard Holbrook, a friend of mine, he was all agitated one time because he had to go to Cyprus and he was trying to talk to the Turks and to the Greeks and to get them cooled down. He says, oh, those Turks and those Greeks. And then I happened to see a paper that day, which I then mentioned to him, and he was a little discomfited. And the paper was about how a new generation of missiles was being sold to the Turks. And then the Greek guy was bidding on them in the same Paris military show, and they were being sold by Northrop Grumman of the United States, where Richard Holbrooke was supposed to be the diplomat. And the weapons were being sold to both sides that he was going to try to stop by his own campaign, his own boss's campaign contributors. Give me a break. Gandhi was correct, in other words. My point is that logically speaking, we know we will not have peace until individuals en masse make the choice to be vulnerable, make the choice to vote against this and that defense expenditure, do tax resistance, whatever it takes, be vulnerable. Don't believe the false promises of security being provided by lunatics. They had a building was blown up in New York City, my city. I was only 4 or 5 miles away. They're going to help with our security. Do you think our security is better now than it was 2 years ago? It's a total joke. It's 100 times worse. The Bin Laden people out there, recruiters' doors are wide open. And the young Arab men are rushing in there, teenagers, ready to die. Ready to run into Iraq and blow themselves up. 100 times, 1,000 times, 10,000 times more than 2 years ago. And these lunatics pretending to us they're increasing our still, oh, we're fixing it. And they're arresting everyone and depriving them of civil liberties under the pretense of increasing security. But the point is, we know better. Now, so what is the alternative then? How do we win this battle? Bishop Tutu basically was referring to what happened in South Africa as a miracle. He says even just before the election, the fateful election, when they elected Mandela, when the blacks were allowed to vote for the first time, and when everyone elected Mandela, he said that they expected there was like about to be an insurrection and the Inkatha Zulu were about to freak out. I was just reading about it. And they thought it's not going to happen. It can't happen. A good thing. We were all indoctrinated to think that a good thing can't happen. It just won't. Something go wrong, you know. That John Broca, the NBC, the BBC, they'll be out there showing what went wrong. And it won't happen. We're indoctrinated and brainwashed to think. It can't happen. That's why we won't put our real energy into it. We're going to keep our own security. We're going to pull back. But he did. It did happen at that time, for that time in South Africa. Bishop Tutu thinks it's a miracle. But what can be done to see to it that the miraculous takes place? Well, I'll tell you what. What you're doing here right now, what I'm doing, what we're all doing, what Robin and Cody are doing, that is what will ensure that it takes place. This is a tiny drop in a bucket, of course. For example, at my own home university. In other words, what I'm saying is cool heroism is an educational problem. It's an educational issue. You can be educated to become a cool hero or heroine. You can learn to rewire your anger responses, reactions. They are not hardwired as some fake biogrammarians, as they call themselves, say, as some people who promote the selfish gene say, who try to tell us that we are nothing but some sort of biological products and that we have no spirit, we have no mind, we have no soul, that mind has no control over matter. Meanwhile, we're human beings, and anyone who really examines a human being carefully, I mean scientifically, I don't mean religiously, I mean scientifically, knows that the main thing about human beings is that they are, of all animal forms that we are aware of, completely malleable. A serial killer can become a saint. A sort of saint, some kinds of saints can become very evil and negative and exploitative. As long, of course, as there's egotism, instinctual egotism ingrained there and hasn't been uprooted, there's a danger always of becoming negative, anyone. Even if they can control themselves by categorical imperatives or system of ethics or religious views or convictions, in the long run, if they don't go down and change the instinct, there's always some danger. But the instincts can be completely changed in human beings. Anybody who denies that is not aware of how many thousands of charges of the Light Brigade in human history. Hot heroism proves, beyond shadow of a doubt, that the human being can completely change their wiring. It's just that they do it out of hatred. The warrior does it out of hatred. Hatred can overcome the survival instinct totally. What the education that they perfected in India, the yoga of cool heroism, which pacified Asia, relatively speaking, in relationship to the West, the more poor, backward, and barren West, and violent West. The West, which conquered the planet due to its backwardness. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Oh, sanctified spirits of Oxford, there you are. It reached out and conquered the planet because of its relative backwardness. Columbus, why was Columbus trying to get to India? He wasn't looking for the Aztecs. He wasn't looking for America. He wasn't trying, didn't want to go play baseball. He wanted to go to India to get some spices, some perfume, some rubies, some diamonds. He wanted to go rob and loot and pillage in India because you couldn't get that much out of France. Agincourt, what do you get in France? A little perfume from the south.
The Bob Thurman Podcast is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons, no derivatives, non-commercial license. Please feel free to share on your favorite social media platforms. Hope you are staying happy, healthy, and safe during the quarantine. Tashi Dalek, and thanks for tuning in.